Misty, and welcome to RetroTech. This is a new show about iconic Microsoft products from the 80s and 90s. In this episode, we'll be talking to people from Encarta, and we're going to start with introductions.
I'm Anthony Keller. I work in Xbox Live today, and when I started in Encarta 21 and a half years ago, I was a tester.
I'm Brian Mantis. I work on Edge. I started with Encarta as well.
Andy Woods. I was an engineer on Encarta all those years ago. Right now, I've been in Xbox for the last 7 or 8 years.
Hi, I'm Lisa Woods, and I started on the Encarta team almost 25 years ago as a program manager. Today, I work in Microsoft Azure.
All right. Well, thank you for everyone for being here. We really appreciate it. So I've been researching Encarta for the past several months, and it's been great, like being here in the future and then going back. And it's almost like I'm stepping back in time and like looking at this amazing product. And it's hard not to get attached to it because I can see in the paperwork and in the specs and in all of the postmortems and everything that with each version, Encarta got better and all the different changes that you all made and the impact of those changes. Like as the product went on, and it's kind of sentimental to go back and look at that because it's like I'm seeing this, you know, looking back from the future. So thank you, like I said, thank you all for being here. So one thing that I really liked about Encarta was Encarta's designed with the illustrations, animations, and maps in mind. And I read that and that really stuck out to me. And I was wondering if any of you could talk a little bit about how the process worked for creating an image and an illustration or a map, or like what did that process look like, or does anyone have any short stories that they would like to share?
So I do have a story, not necessarily about creating it, but trying to fit it into the product. And I do remember most days having to actually reboot my machine because we were pushing the limits of what the hardware was like. So we'd get these beautiful videos or images or whatever kind of a shockwave tech, like, you know, multimedia technology. And we would be trying to develop them in, and I would like reach under the desk, oh, reboot my machine again. And that happened multiple times a day. I don't know if the other engineers came up with that same thing. And we were literally just pushing the bounds of what was possible in hardware at that time.
Do you want to talk about fitting on discs?
Yeah, one of the interesting aspects of planning Encarta year over year is that when I started on the Encarta team, we were actually shipping it on a single CD-ROM. CD-ROM, not DVD-ROM. The second version, we went to two CDs, and then, you know, eventually went to DVDs. But one of the most difficult things year over year at that point was figuring out how to fit the media onto the disk, because ultimately we wanted to include as much as we could, and it was a zero-sum game. So for every image or video we added, or map or whatever we added, we would have to take out other content. So there were always these heartbreaking decisions at the end of every year about, you know, what are we going to remove so we can fit in all the new media for the revised China article or whatever. So that was an interesting challenge.
And on the build side, we had the same kind of problem of, okay, we have this much to fit. if you're going to switch disks every time you change articles, that's not going to work. So we had to kind of make it to where you could switch articles and you'd get a smaller version of the media. But if you wanted the larger version of the media, then you'd have to switch disks. So there was a lot of kind of user experience smoothness to worry about making it to where you can hop from article to article without a problem. But if you wanted to go deep into the media, then you might have to switch disks. Getting to DVD was a godsend because you're back to one disk and you don't have to reach below and pop it out. And
there was a 5 CD version of Encarta while there. And just to put things in perspective, a CD, 650 meg, and nowadays when you download a game, it's easily 40 gig.
Yeah.
Right? So just like orders of magnitude larger. And today no one blinks. Oh, yeah. The new Halo is 60 gig. Oh, and there's an additional 20 gig for my new map pack.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was also a really big thing when we finally introduced the feature where like hard drives on machines got big enough that we introduced a feature that you could install the entire product from all 5 CDs onto your hard drive. Because I think it's impossible for teenagers, whatever, people today to understand the whole idea of working on, you know, a product where you're dealing with the physical constraints of a disk. And it, like, I had forgotten what Brian was talking about, that you know, you could scroll through a very long article and all of the text was on both the disks in the version where we had two CDs. But if you were scrolling through a long article and clicked on something to expand it, you would get hit with this prompt to take out the CD that was in there and swap in the other one. So you know, Brian went and others went through all these machinations to try to minimize the inconvenience of that. So
and then not just the engineering of making that possible, but then testing to make sure that it worked correctly and all the matrix of different cases and situations that you could be in. With the also respect to the fact that not only could you navigate forward, but you could also navigate back. And navigating back now, did that mean you got the smaller version of the image, or should you have to switch disks? And so, that was challenging.
So, and navigating back is an interesting thing because, again, today, forward buttons, back buttons, it's just a part of everything that we do. But introducing a back button into Encarta was a massive planning and design and development effort.
Yes, it was.
And the point that Anthony was making too about testing, in the time period we're talking about, testing was virtually all manual. This was before people did automated testing, and so much of it was about the user experience. So basically, we had people who sat there all day long and browsed through different articles and features and so on, and just to unearth these weird edge cases where, it, you know, if you go through this sequence and then click the back button, you'd wind up in the wrong article. Fun times.
You had mentioned when we were talking earlier that you have old versions of Encarta installed. One of the things to play around with is, in addition to the media, in addition to kind of the nice art on the UI, screens on screens on screens on screens. And, you know, you go several screens up, I guess, and then you click something to navigate to a new feature, and they all tear down. Now you click back. You've got to build all that back up.
Yeah.
That was a lot of work.
Yeah.
And sweat and tears and testing. And I don't think anybody's done that since.
Make everything flatter.
Why would you now? Uh-huh. Make everything flatter? Like.
Yeah.
We kind of learned our lessons, but back then that was the starting point. And that was
Could you all share a bug that you worked on that was just kind of like kept you up at night and something that you'll always remember, like, oh, wow, I remember that bug, and like maybe something today would remind you about that bug, or something that you all worked on that it was pretty difficult to debug?
You want to go first?
So I have palette flashing bug. Back in the day, we could only...
Angry fruit salad?
Only have 256 colors, and we would actually bring up different collections of colors for different images or different features. And close to the ship of, I don't know, 98 or 99, there were bugs. There was a bug where we just could not solve it at all. And in the end, it was like, fine, we gave up. And we said, whatever happens, we're just going to wait half a second and then just force it. And so you'd like get in bad colors and then boom, good colors. That was the palette hack. And it was literally like, just fine, give up and just stomp on it. And it was kind of horrible, but we shipped with it.
Yeah, I don't have a story about a particular bug that comes to mind, but I do remember... you know, we would have daily or it got to daily near the end, sometimes twice daily of bug triage. And if you were, I mean, as testers, we were the voice, the what we hoped was, a voice for the customer. And, hey, this is a big deal and it's going to be so painful to run into this thing and you've got to fix it. And it was kind of like court. We called it bug court, in fact. And you would go there and you would sit, and when they got to your bug, you would talk about it, and you'd be like, "And this is how dangerous it is." And if it caused data loss, you know, that was kind of a trump card. You knew you could really play that and get that prioritized. But yeah, I remember fighting for bugs.
I was the lead program manager on Encarta for a few years, and we'd have bug court sessions back to back. First, there would be sort of the technical, like the dev bug court, and you know, one group of people would come and cram into my office for that. And then later we'd have the editorial that was about, you know, content issues and errors. And one of the things that I think, you've made in Carta so special and so dear to most of it was just how beautiful and visually rich it was. We had these amazing designers on the product who were just Adrienne O'Donnell and Sheila Carter and, Angela Butcher. They created these beautiful designs, but were also very, very particular, which is part of what made the product really special. But we'd wind up, you know, having impassioned arguments because one particular thing was a pixel off
didn't
in one
line
direction
up.
Or another. So, can we fit it in? Can we fix it? And then I remember, you know, times when a developer would like, oh, all right, I'll just work the extra hours to fix that one pixel to make the designers happy.
Well, I saw those things too. In fact, I would take screenshot and zoom in to show that it was exactly one pixel off.
Yeah. People sometimes in bug court, it's like, okay, you can pick one. People would come in with a whole list of here are the bugs, and it, you know, as you got closer and closer to launch, we'd have to push towards, you know, zero bug bounce, ZBB, right? And you either got there by postponing bugs or by fixing them, right? And people would, you know, have a long list, and it's like, all right, you can pick one, but you know, when you come down to the fit and finish, you'd have to decide which one that you were most attached to.
And earlier on, we would have design would say, here's my design, and you talked about specs printed or online or otherwise, and there'd be like 6 colors that are wrong, and then it's 10 colors that are wrong, and then it's 15 colors that are wrong. And so there were sessions where I was telling earlier, where we would sit down and like, okay, you've got the dev sitting at the desk, designer sitting next to them. Here's the spec. Here's what the colors are supposed to be. Okay, let me go change this screen. Let's get this screen right. Okay, that one's done. 5 minutes later, we're on the next screen. And I had like a 2 or 3 hour session with Adrian at one point where it was
literally going through. We call those design days, right?
Going through every screen. That color's not quite right, but it's good enough. Let's move on. And this was before we had like accessibility guidelines and standards in Windows about all apps look this way. And even the ones we did, part of Encarta's kind of branding and style was that we're going to draw in the non-client area, which is the frame of the window, and it's going to be a work of art. And that's the goal, because we want to pull kids in. Mm-hmm. One was to pull kids in, and the other one was to show off what a, you know, then computer or PC could do with a CD drive. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody had done, like you were saying, in 650 meg, throw in a whole bunch of content that like could engage a kid for like hours.
Yeah.
And or an adult, if you were kind of trapped.
And before we leave bugs, contrasting that to especially services, we do software today, because we actually gave you something in a box that you took home, there was no, until the later years, connection with any sort of internet or network so that you could get an update. And so that was part of the reason why bug discussions and bug court were so tense, is because how can we let this is there forever, you know, we have no chance of fixing this. And the closer we got to our RTM date, release to manufacturing date, the higher that bug bar got, and the severity of the bug would need to be such that if we ship this, I mean, and especially after we got to a certain point, if we fix this, it's an X amount of dollars in order to roll things back from, you know, starting that manufacturing process where we give them disks, golden masters, and start down the road of producing those at a mass, you know, huge rate. So today it's, and especially if you came from that era, it's so different, because the focus has kind of changed to look, let's get this in front of customers. Mm-hmm. Let's get this good enough to see, is this something that lands with customers? It might be okay if it's got, excuse me, some bugs. We'll slap a beta tag on it and we'll get some impressions. And if it resonates, then yes, this is something we need to invest in. Mm-hmm. And even if it's not like, look, we're releasing this, we think it's good. If we do find a bug, it is possible to, you know, the next day, the next hour, to push out a code fix and update the service or whatever. And so it's just a way different mentality. Yeah.
And dates were set pretty early and were solid.
Yeah.
Like looking back at the Ship It Awards, the plaques, it's like, boom, August, boom, July. Like, it's ding, ding, ding. Like,
yeah.
It was never September.
Yeah, well, they backed it up.
It was very crisp, but it's like, okay, so if something's quality wasn't good, then we're just going to take it out.
It had to be there from back to school.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
And back then, it was released to manufacturing. RTM was when you were done. And we would, a week, 2 weeks before the absolute cutoff release to manufacturing date, we would start burning release candidates.
Blue and white discs.
RCs.
And literally burning them on discs, and everybody would be testing from discs, just like customers. And then finally we would get to Golden Masters, and we'd do another round of testing with the Golden Masters and would hope that these are it, right? And I can remember one year, I've forgotten which version it was. We found something after we had what we thought was the Golden Master, and so we wound up having to redo it. And back then, manufacturing was done at Canyon Park. Mm-hmm. And I remember one year, Matt Baucus actually, like, we cut it so close to the release time that Matt Baucus actually drove the Golden Masters up to Canyon Park because, like, the normal, you know, whatever the courier process was, we missed the courier deadline. And so that was the year that we were there, I think like two nights in a row. People worked, around the clock two nights in a row. And then Matt drove the Golden Masters.
Do you remember what the bug was?
I don't even remember. Do you?
No. Probably blocked out.
The fact that you brought up the discs. So I remember at first, we didn't even have burners in our office. We had to actually send the files out to get burned in what I think used to be the mail office or the where they do all the packaging and stuff, and go get those. I remember getting stacks and stacks and then handing them out. Finally, we got burners in our office. But that reminded me of one of the bugs that we had where essentially, once we got the disks, nobody had access to our Microsoft network. And during development, sometimes the resources aren't ready in the location that you want them, and so they're on the network somewhere. And so a path to a network share had been coded into the product. And we didn't find it till very, very late. And after that, every time you tested, you had to unplug your network cord, because we wanted to make sure that anything that we navigated to, anything that we showed, was not referencing something on the Microsoft network.
Wow. One thing that I wanted to do was to share a couple of customer memories. These are people who grew up with Encarta, and their families bought lots of versions of Encarta, and they shared a couple of stories with me. When I asked, kind of like on Twitter, what are the Microsoft products from the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s that people like? Encarta was the one that came up pretty much most of the time. And so someone said, for Cubans, Encarta was our internet. And he said, until just a few years ago, internet access in Cuba was only available to those who studied or worked in universities, government, and some work centers. Encarta was the most reliable source of information we had about the world. And that really stuck out to me, and I wanted to share that with y'all and kind of hear what you all think, because through the course of like a week, 2 weeks after I started that post, people just kept sharing these really like emotional stories about how Encarta was so important to them. And it was hard not to get attached to the product, like even just me reading these. So how do you all feel when you hear things like that?
Well, one of the things that I think was so very different about the Encarta team in general was that it was this really rich mix of functional roles. Like, we had a massive editorial team. We had people who wrote content, edited content, did copy editing, did, fact checking, et cetera. We had a massive editorial team. And there was a huge amount of pride and dedication to editorial integrity and to the correctness and objectiveness and quality of the content. And I can't even begin to tell you how critical it was to this huge editorial staff that, I mean, we talk about showstopper bugs for things like palette flashes, but the one thing that would, that was, we would never, ever postpone a bug that related to the correctness of content or, you know, even readability and things like that. It was just, I mean, what we're talking about, it's funny that we've had this conversation has gone on so long without referring to the fact that this was an encyclopedia. And today, I think we have a daughter in high school, and I'm not even sure, she barely even relates to that concept. Mm-hmm. Recently, she looked up something on Britannica.com, and I mentioned something about it being an encyclopedia, and like that word didn't even resonate with her. But before the internet, this was the source of information for so many people. And that it's so hard, I think, to look back on, oh my God, this was a quarter century ago, right? And to think about how profoundly different the world was at that point in time. Mm-hmm. There was no Google. Like, I remember the very first time I heard the word Google was when one of our editors mentioned that there was this new search engine that was really new and different. We started embedding web links into our articles. We had an entire team of editors whose job was to go out and find really rich internet content that was authoritative and relevant to our primary articles and to embed a list of those links in the articles because web search wasn't a thing that ordinary people knew about, and we wanted people to have sources to find ancillary content.
And then hope that those web links didn't actually change over the next three years when that...
Right.
Or go to unexpected places.
Yeah, exactly. And I had to test those features to make sure they worked. But the web links were one of the first things to be updatable as well. I remember...
That's right, yeah.
We could periodically get new web links, and there was one of our first online, I guess, services... was to allow Encarta to start updating itself and get new stuff, new content to display on the home screen, kind of like a showcase or something, as well as those updates to web links and then articles as well.
On the tone of it being the source of truth and information, we were blocked in some markets from shipping until we updated maps to move like 12 pixels so that the borders were correct for where you were shipping to.
If
there was a dispute, two countries neighboring each other might get different versions so that they're both happy with the map.
Yes,
and different articles too, right?
Different articles, yes. India and Pakistan for sure were one.
Talk about like design pixels, you know, this needs to be that. Yeah. No, the map ones, they're really, really important.
Yeah,
get
they were.
Right.
Yeah.
And the other thing that surprised me, like one of the first meetings that I was in, Matt was discussing how important it was for us to accurately assess the amount of disk space we took up when you install, because that was on the box. And people would sue us or try to sue us because we took up more space than we said we would. You know, back in those days, you didn't have gigs and gigs worth of space. Yeah. But even so, I mean, I couldn't fathom somebody saying, you know what, I'm mad enough, and I would like some money, so I'm gonna try and sue Microsoft because you took up, you know, more space.
In the early days, part of the appeal of CDs was you could fit so much more content than you could fit on your machine. So you would have all your games run off the CDs, you would have Encarta run off CDs. At some point that changed, and your hard drive was big enough to where CDs were like the delivery mechanism, so that you didn't have like, you know, 8,000 disks in a box.
Yeah.
But early on, it's like nobody had a hard drive that could fit the entire encyclopedia. So you had to be on a disk.
Yeah.
So yeah, when they started getting bigger, people were like, I got to protect the disk because I've got, you know, my work on that machine or another game for my kid on that machine. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to buy another hard drive.
So one thing that I wanted to do was to play a game called Mind Maze or No Way. So I'm going to read to you. I'm going to read to you a few things, four different things here, and then I want you to tell me if you think this was actually in the product or not. So you say, mind maze or no way. Okay. Oh, never mind me. I'm not a criminal. Just an ordinary guy who likes to sit in the stocks now and then. No, really. No need to pelt me with rotten tomatoes or anything. No, sir. Just solve your puzzle and be on your merry way.
I'll guess mine means.
I would like to say no way, but that is just too sophisticated an example, and I'm going to say it's got to be actually
just
in
right
the product.
Too.
Yes, exactly.
Comical.
The only thing that gives me pause is the rotten tomatoes, because that's kind of a modern thing, but yeah. I don't think it was tying
it's
into that.
It's just cheesy enough to be real.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was in my maze. All right. I'm just a servant, so I shouldn't complain. But it annoys me a bit that politics between people in power are making my life so difficult. I have no quarrel with any evil wizards, but here I am stuck in this curse. And who do you think will have to clean up when it's all over? Me, of course. The king has talked about laying me off. Sometimes I wish he would. Oh well, it's a living. I wish I could figure out this puzzle and be a curse breaker like you.
That totally sounds like my nose too.
Sure.
Yeah, so that was a mind maze.
Wow.
These are, yeah, those two are some of my favorites. Then we have, oh, hello, can I get something for you? Perhaps a cup of hot tea or a blast. Stop it, Joseph. I'm so pathetic. I've had days and days by myself without work. And how do I spend it? Feeling awkward about not serving anyone. I'm bored by myself. Can you answer this riddle so I can get back to my job?
I don't think that one.
Three in a row.
I don't think that's.
I think it was there.
Yeah,
I think it was there. It's sufficiently cheesy and
it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
And you, I think you had to enter your name, didn't you, when you started, so that they could fill it in for stuff like that. So I'm guessing when you played it, you might have used Joseph.
So that was real?
That was real.
Yeah.
I didn't use the name Joseph, though.
Oh, okay. Wow. Oh, right. So it just...
Huh. Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, he was, I think, one of the characters was talking to someone else. Okay, so here's the last one. Trying to lift the curse, eh? Don't waste your sympathy on the king. He doesn't deserve it. He's actually proud to be named King Miser the First. Do you know what else? He's the only King Miser, so he doesn't need to be called the First. He goes by the First because it means he gets two extra words for free. Please rescue someone else. Someone decent enough to give his brother-in-law some land and a little gold. Don't solve that riddle you're hearing.
Okay, 4 for 4.
That's gotta be
right. That sounds like close to the finale.
Yeah.
Did the game actually have an end? Like you could actually solve the whole thing?
I think so.
It did.
Yeah.
And someone had to test that.
Yeah.
Again, hotkeys,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah. So that's real?
Yeah, that's real. Yeah.
Wow.
So those are some of my favorites.
Uh-huh. So I'll repeat a story I was telling earlier. We talked about how it was a zero-sum game, and to add new content, you would have to take content out. And we also talked about sort of the editorial pride of people on the team. You heard how cheesy that dialogue was. When we were doing Encarta back in the day, we had no telemetry on which features were most frequently used, and that kind of dialogue, and also just the super cheesy graphics of Mind Maze kind of rankled various folks on the team, and we had no idea how popular that feature was. And so one year when we were making those very hard content decisions, we decided, you know what, we'll just take Mind Maze out and nobody will ever miss it. And, I think that was the year that we rewrote the China article and we brought in all this very rich, like huge, expensive, discs consuming media. And we took Mind Maze out and the backlash was unbelievable. People were so mad to lose Mind Maze. But we just had no idea. We all thought it was just this, super cheesy feature. So.
And it was, but it had appeal.
Now I need to go back and replay that game.
Yeah. I remember also that when I started, screens were about that big. And so Mind Maze, fit very well and took up a lot of the screen. But as time went on, screens got larger. And Mind Maze was still this small, tiny
640
thing.
640 by 480,
And so, it's just the change in technology and what it allowed us to do. Article space got larger and the ability to show larger media inline. Yeah. And just, yeah. Wow. But I remember my maze was always the same size, no matter what monitor.
Yeah, yeah, because we were absolutely not going to invest in redoing that media. Right.
And we didn't scale it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Nowadays you would scale it at least.
Misty, when you played my maze, did you bounce back and forth between the game and the articles to like actually go and answer the questions?
No, I did not. No, I didn't. I didn't even know. I didn't even know if it would like allow me to do that. But I did jump between different topics. Like, I think there was one about science and then there was one about technology. Like, you got to choose what kind of questions that you wanted asked. But I didn't know if it would let me go back to look. So I didn't look it up. So if I would be on a topic and then I would just do really bad or whatever, then I would just skip to a different topic. And then it was funny because sometimes when you'd back out of a room and you'd like try to retrace your footsteps or and whatever, it would ask you, do you, if you clicked on the wrong thing or something, it would say, hey, do you want to change your topic? And I'd be like, no, I want to just do this topic. So, I mean, I did in the game, but I didn't actually go out of the game and look up articles. So one thing that seemed apparent to me from reading everything was that it seemed like you all were a very close community and you were all really close. And a lot of the same people worked on each product together. And you all knew each other really well. And so, can you share a story with us about how you all were working together?
Yeah, I mean, Microsoft was my first experience in the professional world with software. And it was just like everybody during crunch times was vested in making it the best product that it could be. We all were passionate about the bugs. We stayed late, and it wasn't just, you know, one or two people staying late. It was everybody, you know, and at that time we had catered dinners, and I thought, man, this is great. You know, not only do I like what I'm working on and the people I'm working with, but they're buying my food, they're buying my dinners. How fantastic is this? And so, you know, when we moved on from an Encarta, it was quickly apparent kind of the difference in culture that we had, how different Encarta was to the groups that I went to after that. And it took coming back to Xbox or coming to Xbox in the first place to find that feel again, that drive to really push for the customer and to deliver something of value. And that'll always be a fond memory for me. It's one of the best times that I had here.
I think what I cherish about the culture is that in an engineering heavy company, all functions were equal in Encarta. And it wasn't just engineers and then we'll just have some art or some content afterwards. Like everyone was equal, like the designers cared enough. And so there was some engineers, but there were also designers and there were people that made the media and there were the people that did the graphic design and there were the content editors. And so everyone had an equal say and it really took all the functions and all of the people with the left brain and the right brain and the creative and the geek all to come together, and really it wasn't just engineering driven.
I think it left a mark on all of us. Like when you sent out the mail to say, hey, you know, who's interested, I think it got up to hundreds of people, it felt like, or at least 100 people. Yeah. And, you know, just seeing the names and going, oh, I remember, I haven't talked to that guy in a while. Like, I want to meet up with them. And like, I mean, A, the culture of the team, keeping the team, you know, kind of tight-knit, but also, it, as you were saying, first experience in professional or at Microsoft, and you wanted to keep working at Microsoft partly because, like, this was cool. What's the next chapter? I want something like this to continue. Like, some teams you go to and, like, you burn out, like, right away because it's like, okay, this is just a business, so there's no, you know, feel to it.
Yeah. I mean, 25 years later, it is still the best team, the best product I've ever worked on in my entire life. And I think the diversity of roles and perspectives and the mix of left brain and right brain was a huge part of what it made it such a rich experience. But it also really felt like family. And part of it too was that, you know, we always had this fixed ship date. And so in at least the 3 or 4 months leading up to that, people were working 12, 14, 16, sometimes 18 hours a day. You were just always there. And you knew when people's parents were sick and when people, you know, got married and so on. I mean, Andy and I met on Encarta for a while. I was the, we've been married for 21 years now. And for a while, you know, we were sort of Mr. and Mrs. Encarta. He was the dev lead. I was the PM lead. His brother was the tester on the product. I mean, we still refer to it as sort of the Encarta diaspora. 10 years ago, when they shut down the final online version of Encarta, we had a reunion at our house, and over 100 people came. We counted the number of children that were born of couples who met on Encarta, and we stopped counting when we got to 30. That's the kind of place it was. Like, there was just this connection among people who worked there, and it was irreplaceable.
Okay. You know, I know we just stopped it. The one thing I was going to add was that we were also diverse. I mean, not everybody had a computer science background. And I mean, Bradley De La Hunte had a PhD in physics. We had people that were microbiology majors, and there was value in having that diversity. And you know, today the company doesn't necessarily allow for that type of diversity, but it was amazing. Like, I didn't expect to encounter that kind of diversity when I got here. I thought, oh, everybody's a programmer, everybody's a coder.
Awesome. Well, thank you all for sharing your stories. I love to hear it. We all love to hear it. So thank you. This is RetroTech. Be sure to subscribe and check out future episodes.